and welcome to Scram, the podcast passionate about the Scottish food and drink scene. I'm your host, Rosalind Erskine, and on this episode, I speak to Philip Thompson at Donner Castle Hotel, who told me about how, along with his brother Simon, they have turned their passion for whisky into a new business with the opening of Donner Distillery. From its crowdfunding inception to their drive for sustainability, Phil shares the evolution of the business alongside the running of the hotel and its famous whisky bar. His Desert Island Jams are more vintage laden than any we've ever heard before too, by the way, so listen out for them. I also chatted with head chef Grant McNichol. He told me all about his colourful career to date, including becoming head chef at the tender age of 19. He also told me about how food prices are a huge challenge for kitchens and how game may be the answer to some of these problems. He provides us with great insight into the unique challenges of running a hospitality business in the Highlands. I'm now joined by Philip Thompson at the Donner Distillery, and we're currently in a lovely atmospheric vault in the castle. Could you just tell me a bit about the distillery here and how it all came to be?
My brother and I started the distillery in kind of 2015 into 16 with first productions of single malt in 2017. The kind of idea came about a lot driven by my brother, who we had the bar here at the hotel for many years and kind of had the opportunity to taste loads of amazing old whiskies. And we used to open lots of whiskies, go to auctions, buy bottles, and got really interested in that kind of side of it, looking at older bottles. And we were finding that the kind of these things that we love to drink were getting more and more expensive and less available when we used to kind of open like all these beautiful old 60s vintages of Isle of Malt and, you know, Clymeleish and things so that we loved. And we were like, okay, well, what's the difference? Why are these so different? And we're trying to figure out the production changes that had taken place. And it was just through a lot of like own personal research into why, like what the differences are in production. And we kind of just got a bit obsessed about it and thought, well, we should give this a go. We should try and see if we can distill and see if we can make in the style that we think a lot of these old distilleries used to kind of produce their spirit in. And it's not like one single entity. You can't can't say like this was the main difference and that's why these distillates are fatter or fruitier or waxier or whatever. So there's not one single thing. So we thought we'd try and give it a go. So we had this lovely old fire station at the back of the castle, which was basically just a derelict building that was full of storage. And we crowdfunded back in 2015, late 2015 into 2016. We had a first round of crowdfunding where we basically put together a very generous offer for crowdfunders involving kind of casks and things. Obviously, it was high risk at the time because we had no proof of concept. We had never done this. We'd kind of, you know, it was just an idea in our heads. We'd written the business plan, but it was still, you know, the risk was high. Hence why the reward for the crowdfunders originally was quite high. We pushed on. We got really great support from the original crowdfunding, and we started renovating the building. And probably in late 2015, we started renovating the building, buying all the equipment, trying to figure out how to distill and how to. We had ideas. We had done some work at Strathern, and we had some pretty good ideas. And we took on a brewer distiller from Heriot Watt as well in the early days. He worked with us quite closely, and we built the distillery up from there. So it's still micro, it's still tiny, and we're still producing using our kind of our own principles of production. So like our own philosophies, we use only heritage varieties of barley. They tend to have a kind of higher protein contents than the modern malting varieties of barley. Lower starch content, higher protein, so you get like a less yield, less alcohol, but you get more potential for flavor creation from these kind of proteins and kind of amino acids and fatty acids that are in the barley. Only long fermentation, so minimum 7-day fermentation, so allow for that kind of secondary fermentation, that malolactic fermentation to take place. We only use brewer's yeast, so nice long fermentations using brewer's yeast. So essentially the alcohol is made within a kind of 24-36 hour window where you actually make the alcohol. At that point, most distilleries would, you know, maybe leave it for another 12 hours, then distill it. Whereas we're like, okay, well, let's leave it, you know, for another like 4 or 5 days and then kind of see if we can get some more flavor creation. One of the other main points, obviously it's wooden washback, so we kind of, that are never fully cleaned, and you kind of get a kind of natural colonies of bacteria, and the ghost of every yeast that you've ever used is kind of lingering in the woods. So all of these things kind of apply for kind of flavor creation. You know, they all add to it throughout the whole process. Then the distillation, we get the guy, we encourage everyone who works for us to kind of make all the cut points, all the spirit cut points by nose and taste and sight, and, you know, kind of really looking at the spirit and looking at seasonality, the type of barley we're using, if we've changed the yeast variety, and kind of adjusting the cut points depending on all of these factors. So we're not just going, okay, this is what we do every single time, copy and paste. It's like, you know, we really embrace the seasonality, embrace the different barley, embrace the different yeast, the effects that these might have, and then try and get the best out of the spirit and cut it in a way which, you know, is not predetermined, you know, is carried out on kind of a daily basis, depending on kind of the character that we're looking for.
And you've got a gin as well, is that right?
Yeah, so we created a gin back in 2016, which had a kind of malt content to it, so 10% single malt. And we've just started phasing that out, and we, for something which is a little bit cleaner, also it keeps all of the malt for filling into casks for whiskey, you know, that's kind of why we're doing it. So, but we also created this gin. I wanted to make something that was like a total crowd pleaser, something that's super clean, super fresh, very bright, very citrusy. So it's 100% organic. So we have a base blend, which is our base botanical blend, is juniper, coriander seed, black pepper, and other botanicals. And then we run single distillations on top of that of what we get is fresh European citrus in season, so from kind of, you know, October, November until early March, we can get these fresh seasonal European citrus fruits. And what we do is we peel them fresh, we vacuum pack them, and then we freeze them down. You're kind of breaking down the cell walls by each one of those processes, so peeling, and then you're vacuum packing it, compressing it down, then you're freezing it, and you're helping break down the cell walls, and that'll allow us to kind of access all those beautiful oils and esters and flavors that are kind of trapped within the citrus peel. So we get European Italian bergamot, we get Italian lemons, and we get Spanish oranges, and they're all peeled fresh. So we've just, like, you know, this year we're working our way through, I think our last batch was like 500 kilos of lemon, so it's like a hell of a lot to peel, but it's all done by hand. It'll take like three of us a day to kind of sit there and get through it, but it really makes such a difference to work with fresh citrus over dried citrus. You get such a brighter flavor. I sometimes find personally, for my taste, the dry, you get this kind of, it's a little heaviness to it, that the fresh doesn't, you don't really get that with the fresh citrus. So that's kind of one of the main things. We also use fresh bay, fresh rosemary, fresh thyme, and then a single distillation of juniper as well. So the bay is processed fresh as well, which I think, you know, if you like to cook, fresh bay versus dried bay is a completely different flavor. You know, it's a completely different flavor. And I love bay. It's literally like, it's like a flavor enhancer. It brings everything together. So it's like, you know, you put together a casserole or stew or something, you always put a bay leaf in there, and you're not quite sure what the bay leaf does, but you know it does something, and it tends to just kind of bring everything together and add this kind of really nice kind of base note to it. So yeah, that's kind of how we approach the gin. And then we also now do take the approach of almost like a whiskey blender, and we'll blend it to taste every single time. We'll try and get a bit more kind of balance. We don't have like a set, you know, it's always this much lemon, always this much orange. It's kind of based on, you know, we might have different citrus coming through, the distillation cut points might be slightly different. We might have a little bit more kind of heads, you know, kind of brighter notes from the citrus heads coming in, and one distillate that we're happy with, that don't cloud, they're not oily, and we want to bring them into production. So we kind of blend it like a whiskey blender, and I think we're super happy with the product. Now we just got gold in the World Gin Awards for Scottish Contemporary Gin. So that was kind of cool, nice to be recognised that we're making a very good product by people who are in the industry, which is quite nice. So we're hoping to see a little bit more uptake on that, because we're super happy with it. And it's getting in some great venues as well now. We're getting it kind of listed in a lot of cool, very, very good venues, and good level of support. But yeah, just a nice crowd pleaser, really nice, fresh and clean and bright kind of gin. And, you know, it helps, definitely helps kind of us make our very expensive malt whiskey, or expensive by production standards. You know, it's not going to be as expensive at the far end. It's a matter of pence on the bottle, but on the front end, you really feel that cost. So the gin really helps kind of support that as well.
And they both sound quite handcrafted compared to some other places. Is that something that you want to continue? Keep it quite small, keep it quite in keeping with, you know, what people, like you say, there's not machinery doing your cut points. So is that something that you want to continue on into the future?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's really important to us. We've got quite big plans to expand. You know, we're 12,000 litres of pure alcohol of single malt spirit every year, so it's basically not a lot. It's like tiny by the industry standards. But we're looking to expand to about 150,000 to 200,000 LPA, and we want to take exactly the same approach. So we want to be organic wherever possible. We want to be basically as energy efficient as possible throughout the whole process without sacrificing the quality of the final spirit. So we're, you know, we're looking at like solar arrays, we're looking at like ways of energy recapture, of storage of water, reuse of water and so on. So these things are all really important to us. But what's more important is also having people do the work for us and actually feel involved and be part of the process, and not so when our guys come into work, whatever they're doing, it's something new and something different almost every single time, and they feel kind of stimulated and challenged in their work. And I think that's really important. So we don't have any plans to kind of really automate it or anything, so we're going to take the same approach as we are now, really hands-on kind of production, and obviously it's going to be more employee, which is great, and you know, hopefully keep employing young folk from the area who have an interest in whiskey and producing whiskey, and then keep them challenged. You know, I think that's really important. So, we're going to maintain the production as best we can. And like I said, keep it organic. We're going to stick to brewer's yeast, long fermentations. All of these things are going to make a big difference in what we're trying to achieve.
So you and your brother used to run the bar here?
Yes.
So have you always been into whiskey?
I mean, since quite an early age. I mean, our parents bought the hotel in 2000, and I would have been 15. We used to kind of like dry glasses behind the bar and sort of help out wherever possible. And then obviously when you're working with a bartender who just like would disappear on cigarette breaks, like randomly disappear, you're sort of like stood behind the bar and somebody's asking for something, you're like, oh well, okay, you know, fat small family business, it's just kind of what you do, you just have to get on with it, there's not really much choice. But yeah, we did have a decent selection of whiskey behind the bar at that time. I mean, it was maybe like 40 bottles, kind of standard Scottish whiskey bar. But I think as me and my brother, we went away to college and university, we came back on holidays always with these sort of like, you know, after university and college, it's like, what do you want to do? Well, I'm not quite sure, you know, so it's like, we'll just work for a while and help out. And as a result, we came back and my brother had been here a little longer than me and was buying whiskey for the bar. You know, he was kind of restocking it, and he was finding the stuff he was buying was selling, and it was selling well. There was a good interest. He was becoming interested in it. His passion was helping kind of transfer to the customer, who was then getting really interested in experimenting and trying a few different things when they'd come into the bar, instead of just coming and buying one whiskey and leaving. That kind of knowledge, that good kind of level of service really helped. Then from there, we started buying older bottles, and that's really where we got kind of hooked, is like looking at these older distillates and looking at how they were made, and we'd start going to auctions and picking up bottles and opening them and sharing them and trying them and talking about them and discussing the production and what they were doing and why 10-year-old Lafroig from the 60s is different to 10-year-old Lafroig bottled in the 90s or the early 2000s, and trying to kind of establish these kind of points of difference in it. And that's kind of where our obsession on old style whiskey came from. So yeah, I mean, if we can make anything that's like, you know, 1% as good as 1960s Lafroig, I think we'll be very happy. You know, that's kind of would be a nice kind of starting point to aim for.
And have you ever had anything behind the bar that there's people going, you shouldn't open that because you could have sold? You know what it's like now, things have gone a bit kind of mental with old and rare and auctions. Have you,
absolutely,
do you very much believe it should be drank, or do you, have you seen something and thought, oh, we should keep that?
Well, if I don't think the liquid's good enough, and there's a little bit of a balance to be had. I mean, we've opened so many amazing bottles over the years that are, I mean, the bottom of that cabinet there, you've got like Cadenhead's Lafroig 1967 dumpy bottle, which is probably £4,000-5,000 plus nowadays. There's a bottle of Stromness, which is old Orkney bottle that's from Stromness Distillery, which closed in Orkney, I think, in the early 20th century. We opened that for a show and had that on the bar. We would have made a lot more money that selling the bottle than we ever would selling measures behind the bar and sharing the bottle with our friends. But, you know, at the end of the day, you can't take it with you. So you've got to kind of enjoy it when you can. But yeah, I mean, you do think nowadays, it was easier to justify 4 or 5 years ago. You know, the prices were starting to really climb, but they weren't crazy. Now, sometimes you look at the prices and you're going, oh man, this is like, you know, bottles that we used to open that were, okay, say it was £1,000. And even then you're like, well, that's a lot of money for a bottle of whiskey. Now they're like £4,000 or £5,000. You're going, oh, well, if we were to ever open that in the bar, you would never recoup. Like, you'd never be able to sell it at a price point to recoup any of that money. So you can never replace the bottles in your bar anymore. I suppose that's the thing. You know, we have a stock of old bottles, but the way I'm looking at it now is I'm going, okay, well, it's really hard to restock and buy the good old bottles back in. So we have to kind of like maybe diversify a wee bit and try and find some other things that are a bit different that people are interested in. So there's a lot of kind of modern bottlings coming out that we try and keep stocked up with that people are quite interested in, but it's becoming really difficult. And even now, to like the modern bottles, just to try and get like a bottle of Springbank local barley for your bar is like a you know, it's a total hustle. It's just, it's ridiculous. And, you know, you're like, we're a bar, we open this, you know, your product goes on display and gets shared, but then everyone's hustling for the same bottles. It's definitely becoming more and more difficult. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad, Leo, looking around the room with the empty bottles and things like that, it's, there's so many amazing bottles we opened over the years, and we will keep doing it. It's just like the really super rare stuff maybe kind of tempers a little bit, you know, we may not open as many as we used to, and but we still got great stuff on the bar. I mean, you've got 1957 Talisker cask strength from Gordon MacPhail, bottled 80s. You've got a 1973 Talisker that was bottled for Odbins in about 2001. There's only ever 100 bottles of that made. And so there's a lot of amazing stuff. 1973 Highland Park Dragon sherry cask. So there's loads of great stuff still open in our bar. We try and keep it interesting. We've got a good selection of Japanese whiskey. You know, some nice springbanks from the kind of more modern era. But yeah, it's not as jam-packed with the rarities as it used to be because it's becoming a lot more difficult. But we do try and season the bar as best we can with nice bottles.
And then there's your whiskey. Is it out and available for everybody now?
Yes and no. So we are, a couple of things we do. So we haven't touched on it, but we're an independent bottler. So that's a big part of our business. So we will buy third-party casks. We have a warehouse here in Dornoch. We do all of our bottling, our distribution from Dornoch. So that's a big part of our business now. With regards to Dornoch, because our production is so low, it's like, you know, 10,000-12,000 litres of pure alcohol a year, which is really not a lot. It's very limited. So we've only ever, up until this point, released one cask, which was in November 2020. So last year, in the last financial year, we didn't release any of our own liquid. And it's just because of the availability. You know, we'd rather, if we don't have to sell it, we'd rather just sit on it and keep it and mature it a bit longer. We are about to release a couple of casks. One's going to be for export and trade only, and one's going to be for our website only, which is kind of something we try and do, is find a bit of balance between supporting the retailers and our importers as best we can, but also, you know, you do need the, it makes financial sense to sell it on your website as well. So it's kind of finding that balance to kind of make sure everyone's happy in the supply chain, because, you know, whiskey's booming at the moment, but you've also, like, your importers and especially retailers, you have to kind of support them because they've always been there and they've always been pushing kind of whiskey when perhaps it wasn't as booming as it is now. So we need to kind of make sure these guys are looked after, even though we're in a bit of a kind of a boom cycle on whiskey. But yeah, so there will be more available, but it's, again, it's super limited quantities. You're talking like one cask at a time, and from that cask it might be spread amongst like 12 export markets and, you know, like 12 different retailers in the UK. So it is difficult to get, but the best thing to do is for people to look at our website and sign up to our mailing list, and then that's the best way to get information on what, before anyone else, and what's happening.
Nice. And so the last part of the podcast is Desert Island drams. So if you could only take three whiskies to Desert Island, what would they be and why?
Oh, right, okay. This is, I mean, I could sit and chew this over and mull this over like 24-hour period. Off the top of my head, I would probably, it would have to be something, a Bonfant import Laphroaig from the mid-70s, bottled for the Italian market, 10-year-old, so standard 10-year-old Laphroaig, bottled for Italy in the 70s, from Bonfant. Was these are incredible. One of those, I could literally drink that all day. It's like tropical fruit juice seasoned with peat. That for me is probably one of my all-time just favourite whiskies. Maybe something like a old Brora, so something from the kind of original Clynelish distillery, maybe an early 70s vintage or 60s unpeated vintage, that are kind of these waxy kind of whiskies full of kind of motor oils and old copper coins and really kind of old style flavours. So something from the Brora Clynelish stable from the 60s, 70s, and just for, or oh, you could say 60s Springbank as well, but for sheer joy, probably a mid-60s Bowmore from something like a Fino cask or a refill bourbon, so really kind of lush and tropical kind of fruit flavour. That would be, yeah, so that's kind of broad. So 60s Laphroaig, if anybody wants to give me any 60s Brora / Clynelish, and probably 60s Bowmore, nice and lush and tropical, something like that.
It's quite exciting that Brora's reopened.
Yes, it is very exciting. And I hope that, I love what they're doing. I love that they've reopened Brora. They've obviously made it extremely premium, and that kind of frustrates me a little bit. And I get it, because the liquid's very rare. But also, I think big companies need to remember that, you know, the likes of Port Ellen and Brora, these brands were kept alive by people opening and sharing bottles for at like whiskey shows, you know, so weird geeky guys who are like super into the product, like opening them and sharing them and sample sharing and, you know, starting this myth behind these distillates. So yeah, I feel they've kind of excluded a lot of people with their pricing on their tours, like 300 and whatever it is, 300 and 400 or 500 or something like that. And it's just like, it's you've kind of excluded a huge audience of people that would, I mean, I would say I'd love to go for a tour of Brora. And I would probably pay like £100 and I'd be like, okay, that's a one-off, I'll just do that once. But like, you've kind of shown your cards and been like, okay, well, you know, thanks very much for keeping our brand alive for, you know, the past 30 years, but sorry, if you don't have enough money, you can't really come in and see what we've done. So I don't really like that aspect of it, where it's just kind of seems to me a little bit more financially driven than from the passion perspective. And perhaps they need to kind of rethink it moving forward, that their price points, certainly for the tours, are not ideal and not very accessible. And it feels, as a whiskey geek who has opened dozens and dozens of bottles of amazing old Brora and put them on our bar and talked about them and talked about the brand for years, you know, I don't feel that it's accessible to me and the sort of people that I would engage with. But then it's maybe accessible to people who are members of Skibo Castle and fly into Royal Dornoch by helicopter, or fly from Carnoustie to Dornoch to play golf. Clanleash is great. Clanleash have really, they have a brilliant tour at Clanleash for a really fair amount of money. I can't remember what it is, but it's really fair and it's a great tour, and they've got a beautiful bar. Yeah, that kind of ultra premiumization of whiskey, where it's like no longer just, you know, quite a premium product, it's like an ultra premium product. It's no longer accessible to the people, I think, who really kept the brand alive and really talked about it and loved it, but it's now for the ultra wealthy, which I'm not sure I'm super comfortable with, because at the end of the day, the stocks of these old casks are going to run out at some point, and then you're going to be left with the spirit that you were producing from, what, 2022 or 2021 onwards. So at some point you're going to have to go, oh, actually, the price is now whatever it is, you know, £100 a bottle, £150 a bottle for a 10-year-old Brora or 12-year-old Brora or whatever, when you have no stocks of, you know, 1980 that you can charge £5,000 a bottle for, you know. So at some point they're going to have to revert back to marketing to kind of a more broad audience.
You don't do tours here, do you?
We don't, no, but we do have plans for expansion, and as part of that we will try and include tours, but we obviously encourage people to come to Dornoch and visit the whiskey bar. It's really important. We've got sort of, you know, a nice whiskey community in Dornoch. There's a nice whiskey shop and we've got the bar, and long term we will start doing tours, but I'm not quite sure kind of to what extent and what price point. It definitely won't be £300 a tour, you know that much.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, thank you.
So I'm now joined by Grant McNichol, who is the head chef at Dornoch Castle Hotel. Hi Grant.
Hello there, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Not too bad, not too bad at all.
So anyone that's visited the castle will know you by your name at the restaurant.
That's right, yeah.
So how long have you worked here?
So I've been here over two stints. So I was here 2003 to 2000, tail end of 2007. So I really cut my teeth at Dornoch Castle when I was a young chef. I ended up taking over as head chef at the young age of 19. So myself and Phil, who we just met, we were both very young and sort of in senior positions at the hotel at the time. So Colin Thompson obviously allowed us to flourish as youngsters and taught us a lot. And then I came back 4 years ago this month, actually, to open the restaurant and the vault, the fine dining side of the establishment.
Nice. And where did you go in between time?
Sort of a mystery tour of Scotland, really. So when I first left, I went down to Tariff in Aberdeenshire and opened a gastro pub in the Fife Arms. Then after that, I got, headhunted, really, to go to Simpsons in Aberdeen, which is now the Chester on Queen's Road. I was executive chef there with a team of 18 at 22, I think. Still pretty young, still learning, really. So that was a big job. And then I got involved with a consortium of investors and opened my first restaurant in Pitscotty in Fife. After that, we had, that was called Grant McNichol at Harvey Maguire's. So it was my first sort of restaurant. After that, I got in in tow with a restaurateur in Dundee, and we opened the Byzantium Restaurant Group, which was a Mediterranean cuisine type establishment in the heart of Dundee. And we opened a second one in Perth, and we had a great 5 years. It was really, really good. And then basically it just ran its course, and one of the directors had left and opened another restaurant, which was more or less a copycat of the Byzantium. And we just decided that at that point we were going to rent out the space and allow someone else to have a go of the restaurants. So after that, I went to Rufflets in St Andrews as head chef, which was great. I really enjoyed that. It was a big wedding venue, and we had our own garden there, a full-time gardener. So a lot of the produce on the menu came from the garden, which was absolutely superb. Then I got approached by Phonap Castle up in Pitlochry. The general manager that had taken over there was from Fife, Niall Thompson, and he approached me and asked me if I'd like to take over as executive chef at Phonap Castle, which I did. And my previous business partner got back in touch with me in Fife with regards to opening a chain of coffee shops and another restaurant. So I left Phonap to go and do that. I'd done that for a wee while and realised that side of the business wasn't really interesting me. I missed the sort of more fine dining side of things. And Colin phoned me up and asked if I could help him find a new head chef for Dorner Castle. At the time, I was free as a bird, I suppose, and I just decided to come back up, and with the caveat that we were going to open a fine dining side of the business and also that I could open the restaurant here at Dorner Castle.
And have you always known you wanted to be a chef? Like, have you always been into food? And
yeah, I think so. I mean, I was a waiter. I started off in dishes here in Dorner when I was in school at the Malin House Hotel, which isn't even here anymore, at 12 years old. And I've been in the industry ever since. Waitering, dishes, I've done housekeeping, I've done sommelier. I've done all aspects of the business, but I really enjoyed the kitchen side. I'd done a year at North Highland College once I left school with my then boss at the Ulster Arms in Halkirk. And Stephen really, really taught me a lot about the industry and really gave me a passion for cooking. At the time, he was the only Rosette establishment in the whole of Caithness, so, and one of the first in between Caithness and Sutherland. So the standard of food was very high, and it really got me excited about it at a young age. At 15, I was already in the kitchen cooking and really enjoying it.
And do you come from a family of kind of foodies, or was it just something?
My background, my dad was a gamekeeper. So we lived in a very, very, very rural area of just up from Cumbrace on an estate called Badenloch, up the Strathacaldonnan, so single track road for 50, 60 miles before you get to it. And just up the road from Badenloch is the most remote hotel in Scotland. I think it might be one of the most remote hotels in Britain, called the Garvelt Hotel. No power, it has to run off a generator. I still think to this day it must run off a generator, and it's right in the middle of nowhere. And it was just a mile up the road from the estate. So even as a young lad, I was in the kitchen there with Calf, who'd done the cooking for the fishing guests and the shooting guests. I was around that a lot, but from the gamekeeping side of things, we used to get snowed in up there quite often, so you had to really use the land to get your dinner. So from a very young age, I understood that using the produce and respecting the produce was very important, and I've continued that through my menus all the way through my career.
And have you found that people are a bit more into that in recent years than maybe they were a few years ago?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think I've just recently had a conversation with Ardguy Game here, a local game dealer I've known all my life. Our dads played rugby together and we played rugby together as kids, so we've just had the conversation. My brother's still in the industry, he's still a gamekeeper. He's a gamekeeper local here up in Tressidy. So we're just talking about the food cost and food miles, and the thing that game has always been seasonality. You can only use it in the season because it's only fresh then. But the big conversation we're having at the moment is the food cost. You know, lamb, beef, we're buying, you know, duck from France at a premium cost on the menu. Food prices have gone up maybe 30-40%, and they're only going to go higher with the current, you know, circumstances in the world. So we're really trying to fly the flag for game and utilise venison maybe more than just for the 4 months of the year when it's in season. So we're having all these kind of conversations now because, for instance, a venison haunch steak is almost half the price of its beef comparator. So I think it's very, very important that we look at that. Yes, it is a frozen product, but it's been freshly frozen. So that's key. It's a key thing. For chefs, I've always got this, oh, it's got to be fresh, it's got to be fresh. And I agree, I totally agree. But in some circumstances, some of the things that we're importing from other countries and there's no guarantee that it's not been frozen before, and the food miles that are involved in that. Whereas, you know, I can fully trace where the deer has been culled, on which estate, where it was from. I probably know the gamekeeper, you know. So I think there's a much better story there in the produce utilising partridge. My brother's got a pheasant and partridge shoot on the estate. Basically, we can't get that into the food market. It doesn't seem to be something that people are passionate about using. So the game dealer is struggling to produce it at a profitable state to sell. So the actual gamekeepers are getting nothing for the partridges and pheasants that they're trying to get into the shelves and get people using it. So as chefs, I think it's really important that we try and fly the flag for that.
It's interesting as well, because it's venison and partridge, you sort of think they're, like a normal consumer might think they're quite high end, like they're for, you know, posh restaurants and whatever, yeah. But if you found them in a butcher, you'd be cheaper.
Absolutely, and plus, you know, the protein levels, and the, you know, you can't obviously say that venison's organic. It's not, because you can't control what it eats. It's a wild animal. But as far as us in the Highlands know, and you know, chefs like Tom Kitchen and top chefs know that it's some of the best meat you can get, and it's here right on our doorstep. And you know, the protein levels from a pheasant compared to a chicken is next, you know, it's night and day. It's just people don't know what to do with it. You know, a lot of the time it's still in its feather. They don't know how to use it. And yeah, I mean, definitely shows like MasterChef and you know, Great British Menu and things like that are sort of starting to come to that way of thinking and try and, you know, show that it's not that difficult to use these things, and it's certainly a lot cheaper, a lot cheaper.
Yeah, because the way things are going, people might need to start looking at these.
Gonna have to, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I look at the lamb price this week. We are getting up to the stages of a rump of lamb being the same price as a fillet steak. It's scary, you know, and beef's only going to go up. I've just recently spoke to my very, very good farmer friend up in Caithness, who has his own herd of cattle. He's got his own butchery from that. During lockdown, he started that, and it's been a huge success. Now, his Aberdeen Angus certified from embryos, Azold Angus, is the best, and is actually Aberdeen Angus, because a lot of times you see Angus written on the label, but it could just be one third of the animal's Angus and they get away with using it, whereas his beef is 100% Aberdeen Angus, to the point where the animal's actually got the traditional jawline and mouth space of the original animal, and that's so it can eat and graze and get more grass in, which you would never think. And you know, Ranald is so passionate about what he does. And because of his passion, I really want to put his products on the menu here. So, you know, we've had a good talk about that this year. But obviously, as chefs, you're like, oh, can I get the steaks? Can I get this? Can I get that? And a lot of chefs don't think about using the whole animal in the front of the animal. So, you know, you've got to think smart about having maybe like a trio of beef dish on rather than just putting the prime item on the menu. Yes, it's easy to open a packet and put a steak on a grill and serve it and charge a premium for it. But sometimes you've just got to think a bit more out of the box. And that's what we're trying to do here at Dornoch Castle. We're looking to put taster menu on this year. We do a taster menu in here, in the vault, and we're looking to incorporate that into the restaurant this year and really showcase the local produce. I mean, a lot of people talk about it, but I'm really trying to do that as well and get the food miles right down.
Yeah, that's my next question was going to be, what can people expect then when they come here to dine?
Obviously, we've had to adapt. Dornoch Castle, we're very good at adapting because we've known each other for 20 years. And, you know, the family, myself, the housekeeper, Heather's been here for over 25 years, myself, and Matthew's been here for, you know, nearly six years. So the key conversations we have, we have to adapt and we have to change, and the last 2 years due to COVID-19, we've been very successful in our changes. To say the standard of food isn't maybe quite the same as it was when I first came back in 2018-2019, the skill set's not in the kitchen anymore. A lot of the chefs have just, after lockdown, have decided that they want a life, and I don't blame them. You know, 19 hours a day sometimes in the kitchen, it's kind of dying out now. It's not going to be a thing anymore. And chefs are getting to the point now where they're almost at rock star wages, and it's not sustainable. I know that from being a business owner in the past, and I realise that it's good for the industry and it's good that chefs are getting paid what they deserve, but who's going to have to foot the bill for that? It's going to be the customer. And with the way the food prices are going, you know, we don't want to get to the point where it's so expensive a customer can't come out to eat. And we're hoping that's not going to happen. But for us to maintain a good level of profit so we can pay the staff and get through the winter here at Dornocastle. And it's very seasonal still in the Highlands, which is a real shame. Even with the North Coast 500, even with golf, all these things, you still have a very quiet time between November and March, really. We had our strongest February ever this year, which is good to see, but you still have to maintain, and a lot of these places close, a lot of hotels close up here, and Colin doesn't do that. He maintains, and the reason he maintains is so he can keep his staff. So he opens all winter at a loss so that he can retain his staff for the summer. He doesn't need to do that. There's a lot of people here, you know, a lot of staff that get their mortgages paid and everything else, and it's difficult. It's difficult to keep the business going. So even looking at this year, I think from our point of view, the taster menu going on, I'm excited about that. I need to have a skill set in the kitchen. I've still got a few key roles to fill, but me and everyone else. And just running with a la carte. And in the garden, our idea this year is to do a separate kitchen out there and have pizzas. Yeah, so we've joined a company called Barrel and Stone, which is an artisan pizza company, and we just basically follow their specs, and we put out a really, really good pizza, and it's great for our business because it's relatively easy to put together, and you don't need a chef on £20 an hour who's needed for the other side of the business where you're putting out, you know, fine dining food. So yeah, I think they're going to see a lot of seasonality, but also things that maybe they're not used to seeing in the summer being on the menu, i.e. venison. You know, of us, say my dad and my brother 2 years ago, that I was going to have venison on in March through to June, I probably would have got the door slammed in my face, I think.
So you're going to say get shot?
Yeah, well, no, not quite. But yeah, I think that's where we're at the moment. That's my thinking behind it. And simply so I can keep the customer cost down. You know, I don't want to be at a stage where a customer's having to come in here and the cheapest main course is £25. It's not sustainable for them either. So I think that's where we're at the moment.
Nice. Essentially good. So like a lot to look forward to for the summer. Hopefully there's good weather, nice pizza.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's just having a few different bows and a few different price points. But even that, a lot of the ingredients imported from Italy. So it isn't difficult. And the cost of that's gone way up as well. So maybe a pizza that you're buying at £9 last year is now £11. And that's simply because the ingredients that go on it, mozzarella and the tomato palma, has gone up by nearly 40% in cost to us. We're just going with the guidelines of the company that supplies. So it is an artisan pizza. It's not your bog standard pizza. Obviously, it's a sourdough artisan base, but even still, it's a premium product. And people tend to think pizzas with low cost and you know, so you've got to get that point across to them. The ingredients that are on top of the pizza are a much higher standard than your normal.
Yeah, it's been a perfect storm of kind of COVID, Brexit, and now everything that's going on with Russia and Ukraine.
Absolutely. I mean, suppliers have been in front of me already January, February, and now they've messaged me yesterday to say that expect more food prices increases. And, you know, we're looking at the menu and we're saying, you know, having to put chicken on it up £20 plus. And you're thinking, wow, what is, you know, this is starting to get a bit ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And we've just got to change the menu as much as we can. But again, with other things coming in with regards to, you know, putting macrons and putting calorie counts and stuff on the food, it's very difficult for a place like us who likes to change the menu with the seasons and likes to adapt as much as possible, i.e. you know, we've got a fish dish on the menu, but that fish hasn't been landed this week and there's another fish coming in, so we tend to do things like fish of the day, traditional old style. But the reason is it's because we can buy at the market the premium product on the day at a price that's affordable for the customer.
Nice. So part of the podcast is a quick fire round to do with food. So it's five questions. If you tell me the first thing that comes into your head, that's okay.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm hungry, I think of?
Oh, my stepmom's lasagna.
Comfort food for me is?
I suppose comfort food, a really nice roast dinner.
My favourite childhood dessert is?
Banoffee pie.
My food heaven is?
I would say game.
And my food hell is?
I had salted shark once from Norway and it was awful. I couldn't get the taste out of my mouth for days. So yeah, that's probably my food hell, yeah.
Thank you very much.
No problem at all.
Thank you to Phil and Grant for being my guests on this episode, and thanks to you for listening. Please remember to rate, review and subscribe. Scran is a laudable podcast that's hosted and co-produced by me, Rosalind Erskine, and co-produced, edited and mixed by Kelly Crichton.